Hello, this is the podcast for our class on Wednesday, September 22nd, and it was class number 8, if you're keeping count. And we're continuing to talk about how you can establish an affirmative duty. Remember, all along our questions, we've focused on duty of care for the last few classes, and we'd said if you're doing something, if you're performing an act or an action in your conduct, you have to behave reasonably. Now, in the last couple of classes, we've talked about when is there something outside that? When is there an affirmative duty to do something when you are not behaving, when you're not performing something, when you're just at a bystander or at some other role, and when there's no other duty of care, how can you establish an affirmative duty? So we looked at the common law ways of establishing them, and we said special relationship, all of those kinds of ways, and then now we're further looking at how to establish affirmative duties. Moving away from the no duty rules to duty established. And all along, we've got to recognize how important policy is too, meaning when you don't have a duty, when there's special duties, or now when we're establishing a duty. Our policy is no duty when you're doing some, when you're just no duty for nonfeasance, so no duty unless when you're acting. And then we're going to see some other times when the policy says, well, even if you've done something, no duty, but not at this moment. What we're looking at right here is when is a duty established by statute? And I want to make sure that everybody's clear on how we used statutes before, say, in Martin v. Herzog, and Tedley v. Ellman. In those cases, as we said in class, statutes were used to set the standard of care. You have to walk on the right side of the road. You have to, when you're driving, you have to put on your lights at night. All of those, there is a duty that preexisted because we're talking about conduct, and the statutes were used to set the standard of care. Sometimes statutory violations can be negligence per se. Sometimes it can be just evidence of negligence. Depends on how the court decides to treat them. But here we're using, in the Erd case, the question is, when does the statute actually establish an affirmative duty to do something, to take action? And the court talks about this statute that required schools to test annually for scoliosis. School didn't test our plaintiff. We don't know whether they did any tests at all, but didn't test our plaintiff, who was then diagnosed much later for scoliosis and had to undergo costly and painful surgeries. So the court, you know, courts, obviously we see as all time, we don't look to expand duties when you had one in the first place. So the court had to look at the statute itself. Make no doubt about it. Without the statute, there was no affirmative duty to test for scoliosis. And the court even talks about this a little bit. And when they said, well, was it maybe, did they have a common law duty? No. Although there's a duty of care from the school to the students that require, based on this special relationship, any specific duties, it just means behave reasonably. So maybe give out shots if there's an epidemic, but this affirmative testing, no, even though it's a serious problem, why do we know it's a serious problem? Because there was a statute. Court looks very closely at the language of the statute and decides that although the plaintiff was in the class to be protected and it was a enforcing the statute is certainly a safety measure, and it's a health measure, and that's a good thing, because the statute provided for other means of enforcement. The key element, private right of action, that is, can our plaintiff sue under this statute directly? Private right of action didn't exist. So this case should give you an idea of how difficult it is, really, to use a statute to create an affirmative duty. Will not happen unless there's some very specific reasons for it. Now, we talked about also in this area about statutes. First, we started talking about the Vermont statute that created an affirmative duty to come to others, the care of others in an emergency, and the distinction between those statutes that create affirmative duty and the usual Good Samaritan statute, such as the example of the one that that's in the slides, the New York Good Samaritan statutes. New York does not create an affirmative duty of care to come to somebody's aid, like Vermont does, but both New York and Vermont, and pretty much all of these kinds of statutes, immunize those people who come to the aid of others, creates an immunity from any lawsuit, except that when they've acted with gross negligence. And gross negligence is just really, really, really risky behavior, you know, beyond negligence. We don't talk about it in this class. I don't ask you to know anything about it, but it's just beyond, you know, ordinary risky behavior. It goes into the almost to intent. And, you know, keep in mind the Vermont statute is a very unusual one. The idea that we might want to statutorily impose a duty to come to somebody's aid, and it also tells you that there's no common law duty. So if there was, you wouldn't need a statute, but hardly any other jurisdictions have statutes similar to this Vermont one. Then we moved over to talk about some special duty rules and special no duty rules, they should be, and started with the case of Strauss v. Bell Realty. And I think we had a pretty good conversation here in class about why we have special rules to immunize utilities and water companies, etc., from liability which we would not have when there's other kinds of mass tort. I mean, I'm glad we brought that up. I don't know if we ever really got to the heart of it. Here, as Strauss points out, the duty would have been based on a contract. Without that contract, they had no duty to supply water or electricity or anything. In the other cases, such as Merck or any other manufacturer, even though they may be reaching millions upon millions of people, their duty was based on something they did. They're manufacturing products. And when you have that manufacturing, when it's misfeasance versus nonfeasance, in that respect, the court doesn't see any particular reason to create the immunity. And I think that's one reason. I think that's a good reason to think about. Also, as it was mentioned, the issue of, you know, you have no choice. It's in everybody's benefit to keep the water companies solvent and not or utilities operating and not overwhelm them with liability. They're publicly regulated. If there's some large problem, it should go through the regulatory agencies and not through tort liability, etc. All those reasons for immunizing. Just think in mind, it's a huge, huge policy reason behind Strauss v. Bell Realty. Immunity here based on the contract, privity of contract, as opposed to, duty based on privity of contract. Just used as a way to limit responsibility to a degree that you can control. Some people are going to lose out. The court says, well, certainly under the Moak case, Moak v. Rensselaer, your insurance should take care of something like that. Doesn't help our Strauss, although I think maybe the fact that he had another lawsuit against his the building owner, the landlord, I think that had something to do with the case here too. Although they wouldn't have, don't get me wrong, they wouldn't have expanded it anyway, even if he had no suit against the landlord. But it does kind of should make you feel a little better to see what the landlord's suit may be able to provide some compensation. I gave the hypothetical about Con Ed digging up Lower Manhattan. Make sure that you recognize why that's a breach or a reasonable care case and not a duty of case. They're doing something. Don't make sure you understand the reasons between action and not and omission. And then we moved on to Reynolds v. Hicks, a huge case for discussing duty to third party. I call these enabling torts because the defendant here does something that enables the dangerous party to do harm. So it's misfeasance versus nonfeasance. Strauss and Erd, duty used to control liability. Here we also are using duty to control liability, even though it's misfeasance. They gave the underage driver the alcohol, even though it's misfeasance. Courts here and courts everywhere deny liability based on social host factors. And it's a huge policy. We're not talking about anything except not wanting, as a policy, to impose liabilities on this class of potential defendants. Court says, yeah, we treat differently. Commercial enterprises. Commercial enterprises can are better equipped to do this. They are better. They can insure against injuries. They just it's part of their responsibility as a commercial enterprise. Courts here say, you know, we're going to people can do what they want. You're the king in your own house. You can do what you want in your own house. It's too burdensome. I maintain that if they had imposed a duty, they could still look at the burden in the reasonable care aspect. But they didn't even want to get that far. So big policy as opposed to that although we have a policy against drunk driving, it's important. Nobody says it's not. The courts say it's more of a policy not to impose extra duties on homeowners or on social hosts. So it's even the jurisdictions that have attempted to have imposed social host liability a few years back, New Jersey did. If it was a minor, if the driver was a minor, legislature came back and nullified the court case immediately. So the popular I think, you know, popular opinion certainly is against drunk driving, but it's also against liability of the hosts, and no court's going to buck that, and no legislature certainly. So we're going to start next class, and we talked about Dram Shop Acts, and I gave you the hypothetical. We kind of went through that a little quickly. So we're going to go back and talk through the hypothetical, discuss the Dram Shop Act a little bit more, and then we'll start in on the rest of the cases after that.